This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says unilateral coercive measures, including sanctions, are in clear violation of international law and tantamount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. The U.S. government blacklists an additional 28 Chinese firms, accusing them of being linked to Beijing's military-industrial complex. Also coming up, the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza dismiss a change in future Israeli policy, saying the new Israeli premier would be no less extreme than Netanyahu. Thank you for joining us. Now, today marks the 32nd anniversary of the passing of the founder of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. The following report takes a look at his life and his ideology.
Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, better known as Imam Khomeini, was born on the 24th of September 1902 in central Iran. He studied to become a religious scholar and in 1963 became a marja, the highest religious authority in Shia Islam. Imam Khomeini was an outspoken critic of the Pahlavi regime that ruled Iran before the Islamic Revolution. In 1963, he was arrested by the regime's security service for his anti-Shah speeches. In 1964, Imam Khomeini was sent to exile, living in Turkey, Iraq, and then France, from where he urged his supporters to overthrow the Shah. On February 1, 1979, he returned to Iran, and 10 days later, the Pahlavi monarchy collapsed. Imam Khomeini believed that Iran should strive towards self-reliance. He viewed certain elements of the Western culture as inherently decadent that have a corrupting influence upon the youth. His ultimate vision was for Islamic nations to converge into a single unified power in order to avoid alignment with either the West or the East, and he believed that this would happen at some point in the future. Imam Khomeini intended to reconstruct Muslim unity and solidarity, so he declared the birth week of Prophet of Islam as the Unity Week. He then declared the last Friday of the fasting month of Ramadan as the International Quds Day. Imam Khomeini was among the world's top leaders to influence boycotts against Israel, starting in 1967. After the Six-Day War between Israel and the Arabs began, he called any relationship with Israel haram or religiously prohibited. This message was, in a way, the initiative that led to pervasive boycott Israel campaigns. The Iranian charismatic leader has been praised by many prominent international figures.
The thoughts and ideology of Imam Khomeini transcend barriers of time and place. He has left long-lasting impressions on the world history.
Imam Khomeini was not only a great leader for the Iranian people, but also a leader for all the freedom movements across the globe.
Imam Khomeini's influence on the world's affair was so much that even some of his enemies praised him.
Ayatollah Khomeini, through a well-thought-out plan, created crisis in the Western world. He made plans with such a lightning speed that political analysts and leaders had no time to make counterplans. Nobody could foresee the Imam Khomeini's decisions.
Imam Khomeini passed away in June 1989 at the age of 87. More than three decades after his passing, the Islamic Republic of Iran continues his school of thought in support for resistance against oppression.
Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has slammed as inhumane and unethical unilateral coercive measures against countries. Majid Takht-Ravanchi said while Iran was hit hard by the COVID-19 pandemic, the sanctions restricted its access to much-needed medicine and equipment. Takht-Ravanchi added that the U.S. unilateral measures have resulted in a spike in Iran's annual mortality rate and made it increasingly hard to procure medicine for cancer patients and those diagnosed with rare diseases. He called the moves tantamount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. In 2018, Washington unilaterally quit the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and reimposed anti-Tehran sanctions. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister strongly condemns the United Nations decision to strip Tehran of its voting rights in the UN General Assembly.
This decision is fundamentally flawed, entirely unacceptable, and completely unjustified, as Iran's inability to fulfill its financial obligation toward the United Nations is indirectly caused by unlawful unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States to punish those who comply with the Security Council resolution.
In a letter to the UN chief, Zarif said taking away Iran's voting privileges violates the UN Charter and the spirit of sovereign equality of member states. He said Iran failed to pay its dues because of extreme restrictions imposed by the US on its banking relations. Zarif stressed that Washington's, quote, economic terrorism has faced Iran with difficulty buying food and medicine, let alone paying its UN fees. He accused the United States of attempting to mass starve Iranian people and condemned the United Nations inaction on anti-Iran sanctions. Zarif noted that, nevertheless, his country remains committed to settling its arrears. On Wednesday, Antonio Guterres said Iran needs to pay more than $16 million to have its voting rights restored. Lawrence Davidson is a former lecturer at Westchester University, joining us now. Lawrence, you got these cruel sanctions on Iran's banking sector, meaning there's little medicine that can flow or come into the country. And you've got children are dying. I've seen it with my own eyes from rare diseases. You've got cancer patients that need medicine that are not getting it. You've got the biggest COVID outbreak in the region. Pharmaceutical companies are essentially afraid of making a transaction with Iran, because, or with Iranian banks rather, because of secondary U.S. sanctions. What do you say?
Well, it's outrageous, isn't it? I mean, I don't hear the head of the U.N. Complaining about U.S. sanctions that have made it impossible for the Iranian government to not only sufficiently supply its own people with necessities, but to pay the dues. I mean, can't he make the connection? And won't he speak out about this connection publicly? Obviously not. So it's a trap, you know? And if Mr. Biden had any principal fortitude at all, he would change this situation, and he could rather quickly. I don't know exactly what he thinks this sort of pressure will get him, but it's reminiscent of what we did, what the U.S. government did to Iraq. Where it killed millions of people and children, and the Secretary of State at the time said, oh, it's worth it. You know, it's so cruel that one only can laugh, I mean, unless one cries.
Right, so as you said there, the UN chief, that's another joke. I mean, maybe it's time to think about another parallel international organization. He's wanting Iran. He's saying Iran can't vote anymore at the United Nations unless it pays its arrears, which has come up to $16 million. How are you going to transfer that to New York unless you're carrying a suitcase of cash? There's sanctions on the banking sector, so you can't make a transaction to the United Nations. So instead of essentially helping solve the problem, he's doing the opposite.
It's a trap. It's a trap. It's a contradiction in terms, really. And he has to know this. But I think he's, he's a political creature. When a UN agency produced a report several years ago condemning the Israelis for their butchery of the Palestinians, he fired the woman who headed that committee because it embarrassed him, and he said it embarrassed the UN, and she didn't follow procedure or some crap like that. And so he's a political creature, and we now see how he's being manipulated and how he's letting himself be manipulated. He's part and parcel of this tragedy.
Okay, Lawrence, thank you very much indeed. As always, Lawrence Davidson there, former lecturer at Westchester University, joining us out of Westchester. Now, campaigning for the upcoming presidential election is underway in Iran. Due to the coronavirus pandemic, election campaigns are held in the form of televised addresses and debates, Yusuf Jalali reports.
The race for the top executive post in Iran rages on among the seven candidates who appear before reporters every day to outline their plans. Plans for a brighter future, stronger economy, and more opportunities for the youth. So journalists rarely ask contenders about what they have done in the past, but what they will do should they win the election.
The first move that my administration will focus on is to uproot poverty in the first year. If poverty is eliminated, our people will excel in culture and enlightenment.
I will pay special attention to the youth and their problems. Unemployment is now the first and foremost issue of our youth. As an economist, I believe that if we remove the uncertainty in our market, we can easily create jobs. Also, I will allow young experts to run at least 50% of my cabinet.
All of the candidates have so far spoken of problems that they blame on the incumbent government. Problems that range from inflation to unemployment. Some of the contenders find the root cause of these problems in the fact that outgoing President Rouhani has put all his eggs in the basket of the 2015 nuclear deal, which is now hanging by a thread.
Nobody can ignore the negative effects of the sanctions on our economy. But at the same time, we cannot reach out to our enemy and appeal to them to lift the sanctions. This method has not worked and will not work. We cannot pin hope on the lifting of sanctions to fix our economy. We should have relied on our own domestic capacities to have a resilient economy.
This year, the coronavirus pandemic has curtailed election rallies and electoral tours. Based on the guidelines set by the Coronavirus Combat Committee, campaigns are conducted through televised debates between candidates, feature documentaries, and speeches. Campaigning will continue until 24 hours before Election Day on June 18th. The Islamic Republic holds an average of one election each year since its establishment in 1979. Now candidates call on Iranians to turn up en masse for this year's election, as in the previous rounds, since high voter turnout is translated into a seal of approval for the legitimacy of the Islamic establishment. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Now, the leader of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement has urged all Muslim nations to mobilize to remove Israel from occupied Palestinian lands. In a speech, Abdul Malik al-Houthi stressed that Palestinian and Lebanese resistance fronts have inflicted many defeats on Israel. The Ansar Allah chief praised Iran as the main supporter of resistance in the region. He stated that the Palestinian resistance achieved a clear victory against Israel in the regime's 11-day onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Houthi accused the United States and Israel of using Takfiri terrorists to divide the Muslim nations. He said those who collaborate with Washington and Tel Aviv are committing crimes against the people of the region. The Yemeni leader also warned foreign aggressors to stop killing the innocent people of his country. The United States has blacklisted 28 additional Chinese companies over their alleged ties with what it's called Beijing's military-industrial complex. U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order barring the companies from receiving American investment. The order brings to 59 the number of banned Chinese firms. Restrictions against the 31 other companies were introduced under former U.S. President Donald Trump. Beijing has repeatedly protested Washington's move, saying it undermines the global financial market order and investors' interests. Elsewhere, Palestinian groups in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip say they do not expect to see any difference in Israel's policy under a new cabinet. A representative of the Palestine Liberation Organization said Israeli Prime Minister-designate Naftali Bennett is an extreme person, just like Benjamin Netanyahu. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said it makes no difference who is in charge of the regime. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qasim said all Israeli cabinets in the past were expansionists and were hostile towards Palestinians.
Yair Lapid, the leader of Israeli opposition Yesh Atid party, informed the Israeli president that he can form a coalition cabinet. This brings to an end the era of long-time Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Under the coalition agreement, Lapid will share power with head of the right-wing Yamina, Naftali Bennett, who would be Netanyahu's immediate replacement. For the Palestinians, however, Netanyahu's removal would be no improvement, especially that the coming Prime Minister Bennett, who was a former settler leader, rejects Palestinian statehood. Palestinian officials say they expect Bennett's cabinet will even be more extreme than Netanyahu's.
For us, this coalition cabinet that was declared to replace Netanyahu's radical cabinet is even more radical when it comes to Israel's policies towards Palestinians. It will seek to expand settlements in the occupied lands. We trust none of Israeli parties. Their policy towards Palestinians won't be different.
Experts say that for the time being, Netanyahu's successors with their disparate agendas are expected to leave contentious issues unresolved. According to them, Bennett doesn't believe in a solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. His aim instead is to take full control of Palestinians. Moreover, they say, Bennett has some red lines he will never cross. He has long championed the right of settlement in the West Bank.
There's a consensus among all far-right parties when it comes to policies towards Palestinians. The two parties have already agreed to keep Area C of the West Bank under their control, which makes up almost 58% of the West Bank. The new cabinet will press ahead with the annexation plan, which is part of the so-called deal of the century.
Under the coalition agreement, Bennett and Lapid would rotate the role of prime minister, with Bennett taking up the post for the first 2 years and Lapid the final two. Experts say Netanyahu will not let it go easily, as the parliament still has about 12 days to swear in the cabinet. During this period, Netanyahu will do his utmost to convince enough right-wing lawmakers to vote against the new cabinet. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
SB7 bill that would introduce restrictions making it harder to vote fails to pass before midnight deadline after U.S. Democrats leave the House of Representatives. Here we present you an article concerning this issue written by Martin Pengelly titled Texas Democrats' Late Night Walkout Scuppers Republican Efforts to Restrict Voting Rights. The article was published by The Guardian Daily. Please stay with us to hear more about the story. Texas Republicans have failed in their efforts to push through one of the most restrictive voting measures in the U.S. after Democrats walked out of the House at the last minute, leaving the bill languishing ahead of a midnight deadline. The Washington Post reported the exodus came at the instruction of Chris Turner, the House Democratic chairman, who told colleagues at 10:35 p.m. to take your key and leave the chamber discreetly, referring to the key that locks the voting mechanism under desks. Democratic State Representative Jessica Gonzalez said after the walkout, "We decided to come together and say we weren't going to take it." She said she objected to the bill's content and the way it was crafted with no input from her party. She added, "We needed to be part of the process. Cutting us out completely, I mean, this law will affect every single voter in Texas." Fellow Democrat Carl Sherman said, "We have said for so many years that we want more people to participate in our democracy, and it just seems that's not the case." Governor Greg Abbott said the failure of the legislation was deeply disappointing and concerning, but vowed to bring it back at a special session at an unspecified date. Republicans showed restraint in criticizing Democrats for the move. Republican State Representative Briscoe Kane, who carried the bill in the House, said, "I am disappointed that some members decided to break quorum. We all know what that meant. I understand why they were doing it, but we all took an oath to Texans that we would be here to do our jobs." Less than 24 hours earlier, the bill seemed all but guaranteed to reach Abbott's desk. The bill had passed in the Senate on party lines around 6 a.m. on Sunday, May 30. After 8 hours of questioning by Democrats who had virtually no path to stop it. However, a Democrat walkout prevented the quorum in the House. In closed-door negotiations, Republicans added language to Senate Bill 7 that could make it easier for a judge to overturn an election. They also pushed back the start of Sunday voting, when many black churchgoers go to the polls. The measure would also eliminate drive-through voting and 24-hour polling centers, both of which Harris County, a Democratic stronghold, introduced last year. Critics say such measures suppress turnout among minorities likely to vote Democratic. On Sunday morning, May 30, Hakeem Jeffries of New York, a member of Democratic leadership in the U.S. House, called SB7 shameful. He told CNN's State of the Union, "Republicans clearly in Texas and throughout the country want to make it harder to vote and easier to steal an election," adding, "That's the only way that I can interpret the voter suppression epidemic that we see working its way from Georgia to Arizona to Texas and all across the country." At a press conference held by the Texas Democratic Party, national figures including former Congressman Beto O'Rourke, former Housing Secretary Julian Castro, and his brother Joaquin Castro, a serving congressman, sought to raise the alarm. Julian Castro said this is going to make it harder for the average Texan to get out and cast their ballot, whether they're Republican or Democrat, adding, but it is clearly aimed at people of color, at Black and Hispanic Texans. Castro said the Republican Party is running scared because they know that this state is changing. Senate Bill 7 is an attempt by the Republican Party to hold on to their power at the expense of everybody else, and we can't let it stand. Michael McCaul, a senior U.S. House Republican from Texas, told CNN he thought the law may be more of an optics issue, restoring confidence with the American people. In my state, you actually do believe that there was tremendous fraud. There was not. Texas has only one pending voter fraud case arising from the 2020 election. Nonetheless, it is the last big battleground in the Republican effort to tighten the voting laws, driven by Donald Trump's lie that the presidential election was stolen. Joe Biden on Saturday, May 29th, compared the Texas bill to election changes in Georgia and Arizona as an assault on democracy. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, since Trump's defeat, at least 14 states have enacted restrictive voting laws. It has counted nearly 400 bills nationwide. The vote in the Texas Senate came a short time after a final version of the bill was made public. Republicans suspended rules that normally prohibit taking a vote on a bill that has not been posted for 24 hours. Democrats protested. The bill would empower partisan poll watchers by allowing more access to polling places and threatening criminal penalties against officials who restrict their movement. Another provision allows a judge to void an election outcome if the number of fraudulent votes could change the result, regardless of whether it was proved that fraud affected the outcome. Election officials would face penalties, including felony charges for sending mail voting applications to people who did not request one. The Texas District and County Attorneys Association counted at least 16 new expanded or enhanced crimes. Republicans are also moving to prohibit voting before 1 p.m., which critics call an attack on souls to the polls, a get-out-the-vote tactic used by Black congregations nationwide and dating back to the civil rights movement. Asked why the Sunday voting couldn't begin sooner, Texas Republican Brian Hughes said election workers want to go to church, too. Colleen Allred, a U.S. representative from Dallas, told the press conference on Sunday, May 30, was one of the darkest days for democracy in America. He said, this isn't legislation, it's discrimination, he added. Chuck Schumer of New York, the Democratic majority leader in the U.S. Senate, has said he will bring the For the People Act, a federal measure to protect voting rights, to the floor next month. But it has little chance of beating the filibuster, the 60-vote threshold needed to overcome the Republican minority.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's segment of Back to Reality, brought to you by Arab English Radio. I am your humble host, Zainab, and in the studio with me, I have the pleasure of hosting two wonderful guests. I'll leave the introduction to themselves.
I'm Muzaffar Haider, at your service today.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for joining us.
And I'm Hasnain Ali. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum wa rahmatullah. In memory of the great, I would like to think of him as the great scholar and mystic, Ayatollah Ruhullah al-Mustawi al-Khomeini. To a lot of people, he was a political figure, political leader, or revolutionary. But I think first and foremost, he was a scholar, a mujtahid, a mystic, and a sincere lover of the Ahlul Bayt, and one who strived through his entire life to walk in their footsteps and follow their guidance and path. So today, you guys, we're going to be talking about the more prominent, the most distinguished, the most salient attributes of Sayyid Ruhullah al-Musawi al-Khomeini. Brother Muzaffar, when you hear that name, Khomeini, what's the first thought that comes to your mind? What's the first quality?
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is his image, his face. You know, they say that looking at the face of a scholar is ibadah.
True.
And that's not talking about the regular guys that you see walking down the street, or, you know, the normal people who attract lots of crowds. No, it's talking about those people who are outstanding, who truly know what they're talking about. When they speak it, you can tell that every word that they say is getting you closer to Allah.
Because they've lived it.
Imam Khomeini didn't just talk the talk. He walked the walk. There are many people who can talk about mysticism. There are many people who can talk about Islam. But there are very, very few who have actually immersed themselves. One of the great scholars of our time actually said about Imam Khomeini that, look, he advised people, and he said, this other scholar, he said, you should immerse yourself into Imam Khomeini, dissolve yourself into the personality of Imam Khomeini as he dissolved himself into Islam. This is who we're really talking about. And sister, honestly and frankly, if we're trying to find the most distinguished features of him, like the pillars of what make Khomeini Khomeini, it's a really difficult task because of his all-rounded personality. I mean, as you quite rightly pointed out, he was a mystic. He was also a scholar. He was also a revolutionary.
A philosopher.
A philosopher. I mean, there are so many facets and dimensions to this man.
And then he was a father. He was a husband. He was a grandpa.
And, you know, there's something about him that when you look at him, it brings tears to your eyes. I remember seeing, because you mentioned his family life, right? I mean, this is something that's often overlooked. But actually, he had such a fascinating personality that in the home, his wife narrates that he would never start to eat his meal until his wife came and joined him and the family at the dinner table. And he would tell the other kids as well. He'd tell
wait
the children.
And
he would say, wait for your mother, okay? Little things. It sounds small, but usually when you look at Imam Khomeini, you know, he has this very deep frown on his face.
Yeah.
And so you
brooding
expect,
look.
You know, he's a thinker, not just a scholar, he's a mujtahid, he's a marja. And so you expect him to be very, you know, sinister and stern, but actually no. He goes to his wife when she was trying to wash some clothes in the fountain in the courtyard of their house. He takes the clothes off her and he says, this is not your job.
He was a charismatic speaker.
Like, he was. He really was.
Yeah, his speeches were amazing. Like, whoever used to listen to him, they were like immediately infatuated by his words. Like, it was a great.
And it was interesting because a man of his level of knowledge was able to speak with everyone, like on an international scale, and people from all walks of life could relate to what he's saying, you know. And that's a Nabawi attribute. That's one of the qualities of the prophets of Allah, to be able to speak in a way that everyone understands. Speaking about his charisma, I read somewhere that his voice and his image was banned
they had recognized this high degree of charisma that this man possessed.
It could have been, yeah.
It's very possible. Yeah. And he has, like, even though he all constantly had, like you said, a brooding look on his face, and he looked stern, and his eyebrows were always in a knot, but there was such serenity, you know, in his countenance and in his features and in that long forehead.
Hey, he's got the bravery in his face.
And bravery, exactly.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Let's make a list. Number one quality, we couldn't. A number one quality because he's such a multifaceted
let's
man.
Let's try.
But should let's, we, yeah, let's see. Like, number one it. Quality, when we say Khomeini, Brother Hassanein, what do you think of?
Bravery.
Bravery. All right. Yeah. So give me a few examples of where, what did Ayatollah Khomeini do that you felt like, yeah, that's a brave man.
Look, first of all, the thing is, you know, he didn't let himself or the people, you know, he didn't let them down. Because, you know, all the world was like, you know, we couldn't fight the superpowers.
Mm.
The main thing what he did is, like, he rose those thoughts in people's mind that you can do anything.
Mm.
Like, he walked in the footsteps of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and, like, you can fight anyone. Like, you can fight the superpowers, beat any superpowers, the Western countries or any countries. Like, he helped the people build. Like, he had the bravery to fight against the superpowers.
Exactly. He had so much courage, that man. Once he was one gutsy man.
He was.
You know? And like you said.
He was. If you imagine it, just to help the listeners visualize this for a moment, right? This is an old man, right? He's old and he's scholarly. You know, he's a typical looking scholar. And there he is saying the Shah must go. This is the King of Kings.
Exactly.
The King of Kings, you know, he's the...
Yeah. And for, I don't know if for our listeners who understand Farsi or are familiar with, like, the different accents and dialects of Farsi, if you go and listen to Imam Khomeini's speeches and lectures, especially when it's on a public stage, he has an accent.
Which accent is it?
He has a Khomeini accent. Yeah. He has that, like, slight accent in his voice. It's like...
He never grew up in Khomein, right?
He lived in Khomein, like, throughout his childhood until his teens, and then he moved to Najaf, and then he came back to Qom, and then he moved to Tehran. And, along the way, he was exiled for a few years.
I see. So that's where he gets it wrong. Okay,
he has a slight accent.
Yeah, he never lived in Khomein, but still he was a Khomeini.
Yeah.
You'd think that someone of his prestige and his fame would have this really, like... You know what I mean? I like posh,
by English standards,
sophisticated accent.
Yeah,
exactly.
Would be, this is, but
exactly, right? Yeah. But no, he spoke with very simple words, and his speech was understandable by everyone. And he got up one day and he said, "The king's got to go, man."
Mm. And I guess we all can agree on this point that his words were his weapon.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Speaking about him like being a charismatic speaker, like, people literally used to burst in tears, like, listening to his speeches.
Mm. True, exactly.
And then many occasions, like, you know, people have said that, you know, his students and the people who attended his speeches, they say that people literally used to cry, and sometimes they used to shout.
Mm.
Man, like, people used to cry before he even began speaking.
Just looking at him.
It reminds me of what Ahmad Didat, one of the most prominent scholars in the Sunni world, said. He said, I don't know what it is about Imam Khomeini. The moment I laid eyes on him, I started crying.
Mm.
And then I realized others around me were crying too. And I didn't even realize I had gotten out of my seat. I was standing up.
It's that spiritual aura. You know?
And I can understand that, because have you ever seen Imam Khamenei, like, for real, like, not on television?
I have, yeah.
You have, right? Okay. All right, don't tell me about your experience. This is my experience, okay?
Okay.
All right, then you tell me about your experience. But I could not see the man's face.
Because your eyes were all misty?
No, my eyes weren't misty.
Then what?
I wasn't crying.
What then?
I had to, because, you know, the listeners don't know this, but I actually wear glasses, yeah. Right? I felt my face because I thought maybe I'm not wearing my glasses. That's why I can't see the man's face right now. I could just see the outline of his glasses and his beard and his amama, but there was so much nur. And it's not worldly light. It's not like what you see out of a light bulb. It's not like the sun. Mm-hmm. It's not like the moon even. It's just some weird
aura.
And it was so bright that I could not see the man's face. And by the way, the person who had just been standing precisely there where he was standing on the stage, I could see him perfectly clearly.
That's very interesting. When you said, Brother Hassanain, that Imam Khomeini, he followed in the footsteps of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, it reminded me of a very interesting quote from Imam Khomeini where he said, in war, we're the children of Ashura, and in sanctions, we're the children of Ramadan. That makes me feel like I want to go to war right now.
I know, right? Yeah.
Bring it on.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, one more quality that I found interesting about Imam Khomeini was that he used to encourage people to put their disagreements, to explain their disagreements. Like whenever Imam Khomeini used to speak or tell about something, and any theory or anything, like he used to encourage people to put their disagreements, like explain them, like if you disagree with them. Right. So normally with what we can see is like the good teachers and big personalities, like, you know, they just tell their thoughts. They don't want any like criticism.
They assume their thoughts are like correct.
Yeah, they assume it to be the final thoughts that I said it, that's the final thing. But he used to encourage people, like, if you disagree with anything,
challenge
just come,
me.
Yeah, challenge
yeah.
me.
Yeah, and that's beautiful. That's, I think on one hand, it shows how humble he was, like the level of humility he had, that he would allow people who maybe studied half the amount he did to come and challenge him and his thoughts and his ideas. And on the other hand, I feel like not only was he brave, he also encouraged us
to be brave,
to speak out, to be heard, to have a voice. So, Brother Mubaffar, so far we've got courage, and what was the second one? Courage and encouragement.
Courage, charisma, and encouragement.
Yes.
My number one thing is faith.
Yeah.
The man had faith.
So much.
And it was an unparalleled faith in his time. It's just, I don't know, can you really put it into words? What he had, this faith, and if you compare it with faith that normal people usually have, right? Is there any real comparison?
True.
That's what I think would be the real main thing. You know, I would jump the queue. I'd put it in front of courage and encouragement and
The one point that we said encouragement, so the point after that is, you know what? I was reading on the website of Imam Khomeini that when he used to encourage people, like people literally, the big scholars literally used to go and ask him, like, I have to go and speak somewhere on the so-and-so event. So what should I speak? Like he used to tell that you need to talk about this and this. But after that, Imam Khomeini used to mention that you should not mention my name. Like, don't refer to me. Like, he wanted to remain like unknown, anonymous. Like, he didn't want, you know, there should be his name everywhere.
Yeah, he was sincere.
Exactly. Was sincere. So that was, like, before we started the show, I had a list of qualities, one of it that Imam Khomeini had. And I truly feel he inherited from his forefathers, the Ahlul Bayt al-Nabuwah, alayhi salam, was his izzah, his integrity, his dignity, his his self-esteem, that pride, that sense of self-worth he had. In front of the enemy's arrogance, right?
Yeah.
And it just reminds me of that verse in the Quran, that izzah, which I have no idea how to translate into English because it's so much more than pride and self-esteem.
I mean, I couldn't have put it better, sister, honestly. That point is so integral to the personality of Imam Khomeini and what he accomplished through the revolution.
Exactly.
It really can't be put aside. And as you said, the verse, it actually encapsulates this point so perfectly. Whoever wants honor, that dignity, then Allah's is that dignity. Allah's is honor entirely.
Exactly. And he relied on no one to give it to him.
No,
whatsoever.
His independence was a divine independence. Exactly. You could see the man not needing anybody to lean on, not needing any help.
Imagine this old man in his 80s waving his hand, saying one word, and millions of people just pledging their lives for him. That's all the time we have for today's episode of Back to Reality. Thank you so very much for being with us today as we did our part in the best of our capability to commemorate the great man who was Sayyid Ruhullah al-Musawi al-Khomeini. I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
The limelight. Experts found homicide rates in the United States jumped by 30% from 2019 to 2020, whilst gun assault and aggravated assault rates climbed 8% and 6% respectively, calling the 30% surge a large and troubling increase that has no modern precedent. The report states, homicide rates were higher during every month of 2020 relative to rates from the previous year. We now present you an article written by Stephanie Pagones under the heading, Study Says America's Murder Rate Increase in 2020 Has No Modern Precedent. The article has been published by the New York Post. According to a new study released recently, murder rates in the United States saw a historic increase in 2020 compared to 2019, with more than 1,200 additional killings year over year in a sample of 34 American cities. A report from the National Commission of COVID-19 and Criminal Justice states, the coronavirus pandemic, continuing incidents of police violence, and rising homicide and violent crime rates each pose massive policy challenges in their own right, but the interplay between them creates even more difficult decisions for policymakers. The report added, despite this difficulty, leaders at all levels of government should take bold action in responding to all three crises. Experts found homicide rates jumped by as much as 30% from 2019 to 2020. While gun assault and aggravated assault rates climbed 8% and 6% respectively, calling the 30% surge a large and troubling increase that has no modern precedent, the report states, homicide rates were higher during every month of 2020 relative to rates from the previous year. Experts analyzed the data from as many as 34 U.S. cities, which varied in size and population, for year-over-year changes in 10 different areas of crime for the year-end update of a report called Pandemic, Unrest, Crime, and Violence in U.S. Cities. In addition to the three offenses listed above, the report examined the rates of domestic violence, robbery, residential burglary, non-residential burglary, larceny, motor vehicle theft, and drug offenses. The rates of homicides, motor vehicle thefts, gun assaults, and aggravated assaults rose year over year. Meanwhile, analysts found those related to drug offenses, larcenies, non-residential burglaries, residential burglaries, and robberies all decreased during the pandemic and during the year as a whole compared to 2019. Not every city provides the same kind of data, of course, and sample sizes for certain types of offences were smaller than others. As for domestic violence, analysts were only able to examine data from 12 US cities. They found that there was a significant increase in these types of offences during the early months of the COVID-19 pandemic, but the rate then leveled out to be roughly the same as it was in 2019. The average population of the cities whose homicide rates were examined was 978,000, but the cities range in size. The report states the largest city in the sample, New York City, boasts a population of approximately 8.42 million people, whilst the smallest city in the study, Norfolk, Virginia, has a population of 245,000. Analysts examined cities' aggravated assault rates to find that they were, on average, just over 6% higher than in 2019, with 6,741 more instances in 2020 than compared to the previous year. Meanwhile, experts reviewed the gun assault data of 15 U.S. cities and found that the rate climbed nearly 8%, with 3,557 more offenses. In terms of homicides, the report examined only those that were criminal in nature and defined homicides as being deliberate and unlawful killings of one human being by another. Analysts found that homicide rates, like most other crimes examined, follow a clear cylindrical pattern over time, rising during the summer months and falling in the autumn and winter. But in 2020, murder rates exceeded previous rates throughout the entire year. The report states there was a structural break in the city average murder rate in June, indicating a large statistical significant increase in rates after adjusting for seasonality and a longer-term trend. The report added, after this break, homicide rates increased sharply throughout July and then declined through the end of the year, though not to levels observed in the prior year. January and February 2020 saw a combined homicide rate increase of 32.5% compared to the same time in 2019. March through to May saw a 19.4% surge, whilst June through to August experienced a 37.2% rate increase, and September through to December reported a 28.2% spike year over year. Analysts found that the pandemic likely temporarily suppressed some murders because it limited opportunities for offenders and victims to interact. But as COVID-19-related restrictions were slowly lifted or public concern waned in the spring and summer months, homicide rates again rose. Despite the decrease during the height of the COVID-19 shutdowns, analysts believe the pandemic may have increased the commission of homicides in multiple ways. Experts found the pandemic disproportionately affected vulnerable populations by creating more stress, whether physical, mental, or financial. It also further strained those groups and institutions tasked with responding to or treating violent crimes, such as police, hospitals, emergency medical services, community groups, and courts of law. The report notes, COVID-related restrictions may have had an initial suppressive effect on homicides, but the waning of those restrictions, coupled with the strain on at-risk individuals and key institutions, aggravated further by the lack of outreach to such individuals, have all likely contributed to elevated homicide rates in 2020. Analysts also noted a precipitous rise in murders during the emergence of civil unrest and protests following George Floyd's death, but added, the connection between police violence, protests, and social unrest, and heightened community violence remains uncertain. They also said they have found so far that no simple connection exists between the trio. In all, the National Commission of COVID-19 and Criminal Justice found homicide rates in 2020 were 30% higher than in the year before, with 1,268 more murders in the 34-city sample alone. Murders rose in 29 of the 34 cities examined, or 85% of the cities. The experts wrote, homicides increased in nearly all of the 34 cities in the sample. They added, in the author's view, urgent action is necessary to address these rapidly rising rates. Subduing the pandemic, increasing confidence in the police and the justice system, and implementing proven anti-violence strategies will be necessary to achieve a durable peace in the nation's cities. The report notes that the federal government will provide a final determination when it releases its official year-end crime statistics in the coming months. It also notes that whilst the one-year increase is cause for concern, the absolute homicide rate remains well below historical highs, adding, in 2020, in sample cities, the homicide rate was 11.4 deaths per 100,000 residents. 25 years earlier, in 1995, the rate for the same sample was 19.4 deaths per 100,000 residents. The report states, and several of the starkest increases were reported in smaller cities with very small homicide counts, where even a few additional homicides can produce a large percentage change. The experts wrote, but the large increases in homicides were not limited to smaller cities. The report found that in Chicago, Illinois, there were 278 more murders in 2020, which equated to a 55% surge year over year. Whilst in New York City's 131 added homicides accounted for a 43% surge compared to 2019 levels. The experts wrote, the three largest cities in our study, New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, accounted for fully 40% of the 1,268 additional people killed in 2020. The report added, whilst there is variation among the cities, what is most notable is that homicide rose substantially in the vast majority of them.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.